The University of Human Unity Project has held Saturday morning seminars for 2.5 years, I believe, 2 years. So this time, it's going to be shorter. Well, previously it was 3 months. And it's going to be held in association with Living Roots, which is an American college-based program on environmental sustainability around the world. They come here every year. They've been coming here for years. So this time we're doing a combined seminar on integral sustainability. Starting on the 10th. But this is a kind of sustainability. It requires continuous effort and some exclusion. So that's the process. And the question last time was, is process enough to explain evolution? A great deal is known about process. And that last week was the introduction to this series. And the last series on evolution ended with that question, because we spent 12 weeks surveying process. And finally we came to the question, does that explain everything adequately in order for us to understand evolution? And not just the process of evolution, but the potentiality of evolution as an understanding of existence itself, as a value system, and not just a scientific understanding, a philosophical understanding. So we call this course the philosophy of evolution. And I've suggested that it doesn't really exist yet, but there have been some attempts to begin to create a philosophy of evolution. There has been in the 20th century a spirituality and almost a religion of evolution from different standpoints. And of course, Darwinism could be looked at a little bit like that. It's a kind of religion of scientists who believe that everything can be explained in terms of process. So one of the things that I'm trying to achieve in this course is a kind of concentration, a kind of assemblage in the true philosophical sense, assemblage of principles, facts, systematic understanding, points of view, reflections, that eventually we dwell upon philosophically in this yogic way that we mentioned at the end last time, where the possibility emerges of consciousness penetrating the barriers of thinking and beginning to see comprehensively and feel and know directly the reality of evolution. To move from a comprehensive understanding of how people view evolution, to use that as the framework for gathering and dwelling in concentration until, as Sri Aurobindo explains the process, the idea, capital I, is the emanation of the reality. And the two are so close to each other, and the reality is so comprehensive, and I mean the idea is so comprehensive and powerful, that it dissolves into the reality itself. And then one has not only an understanding, but one is evolutionary at that moment. One's energies, physical, vital, mental, higher mental, overmental, subphysical, subtle, all the way back to the divine will itself, are resonant with the reality of evolution. Then philosophy has done its job. So we're beginning to gather material of consciousness and understanding and images and theories, which we will allow to go through a process internally of organization and connectivity with, between the mechanisms of consciousness and the world, so that if evolution does express the reality of the world, then we will come directly into contact with that reality. But this is a huge undertaking. And there have only been a few who have really devoted their lives to that undertaking. But those few have left behind a trail that is incredibly deep and vibrant and living. So we can use their indications and their processes, and this at least is the hypothesis for this exploration. Some of us may actually encounter the meaning of evolution. That's the possibility, I believe, which makes it worthwhile to do this. So evolution is not just a theory of speciation, natural selection, variation, coexistence of life systems. It's not just a biological understanding, but it happens to be grounded very solidly in a biological understanding. And so there's a tremendous wealth of energy of consciousness that has been invested in the biological understanding of evolution. And it has yielded concepts that explain language and concepts that explain societies. And it has gone beyond itself in the last 150 years or so, And many fields of human knowledge have been developed on the basis of this biological understanding of evolution. Not the least of which is the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo. So we explored during the first session a year ago many layers and waves and lines of development of evolutionary theory that Sri Aurobindo himself identified. And I've pointed out in these introductory talks that in the supramental manifestation itself, in that volume, which is now in the new edition different, but up until very recently, it was a compendium of all of his essays on evolution. And so there you've got 300 pages of essays on evolution, many of them scientific, or focusing on the science of evolution. Not even to mention all the last 14 chapters of The Life Divine, which are pretty much all dedicated either to yoga or to evolution as systems. So for him, this idea of evolution dawned, as it did for many around the beginning of the 20th century, as not only a scientific understanding, but also as a philosophical understanding of existence. But for us to become aware of all of that is merely to prepare a way towards a heightened understanding of that reality. None of those things are anything more than a frame of reflection. And sometimes that frame of reflection is very powerful, no doubt. But until one assimilates all of that and is energized to it, to the point that it becomes a living reality, it continues to just be a frame of understanding. So in the philosophy of evolution, we've seen through especially the writings of Henri Bergson and all the way up to the 70s with Conrad Lorenz, we have seen a very determined philosophical line of thinking that has identified certain principles of epistemology, of understanding, of human thinking, and the extent to which these principles of thinking are limited. So philosophy has been very much focused on defining the limits of itself, the limits of philosophical thinking, especially during the last century, but since about four centuries, that has been a preoccupation. But with Bergson, we get a really very clear systematic identification of the limits of scientific thought, rational thought. And so he proposes that the next stage of evolution is the evolution of intuitive consciousness. And he writes this in 1907, 7 years before Sri Aurobindo starts writing The Life Divine, which follows that stream of contemplation of human potentials that are in fact being seen intuitively against a background of rational thought. So I ended up last time identifying some statements in Sri Aurobindo's work, The Synthesis of Yoga, which identify this process itself of rational thought identifying its limits and breaking through them into intuition as essential even in yoga. This philosophical process gets transformed by yoga into a consciousness elevating discipline. So I'm going to go back into the synthesis of yoga this evening and survey some of those passages further. And I just wanted to ask, first of all, how many people had time to look on the University of Human Unity website at those introductory lectures that I mentioned last time? Just as I expected. So, I'm going to give you hard copies. That haven't been corrected yet. So if you read it soon, you'll get the mistakes. I'll correct them as we go along. So in the last section here, we have some reflections on Conrad Lorenz. For example, are related to what we were discussing earlier today. Conrad Lorenz spent his life defining the origins of consciousness in animal behavior. And he discovered that all animal behavior is essentially cognitive. Every time that an animal interacts with its environment, it is processing information. Even at the level of one-celled organisms. And he wasn't the first to point that out, but in the 20th century in biology, most really serious evolutionary biologists agree, including Richard Dawkins, that information processing is basically what's going on at the cellular level. So then he observed that there is something called a constancy mechanism that is a mechanism of perception. And it's going on all the time in the all species of the animal kingdom. And the way it works is, as he explains it, the contingent in an event, whatever is contingent in an event, tends to be subjugated to whatever is not contingent in an event. That is to say, the aspect of an event which tends to recur in spite of any contingencies makes an impression on the organism until it is something that the organism understands well, and its behavior becomes a function of that understanding. So this, I'm going to quote, just read this page, this supreme function of constancy mechanism means that somehow your cells and your nervous system are able to tell you what's red every time it's seen, or what's hot every time it's felt, or what's in the right quadrant of your vision and what's in the left quadrant of your vision, so on. This is a subconscious activity that we don't think about. It just happens in our visual apparatus like it does in every other creature's visual apparatus. Even if it's just a one-celled chloroplast or whatever is receiving light, it's giving an indication of where the light's coming from, and it's enabling the organism to either go towards it or away from it. So the whole spatial orientation of life is based upon the processing of light information. Consciousness. That's the fundamental reality of life. This is quite independent of rational abstraction. It is equally proper to higher animals as it is to small children. All these functions of abstraction and objectivation performed by gestalt perception. It means that you recognize a complex field of stimuli for what it is. Now, this is important. We just ended the last hour with the idea that language, essentially, is about what is. All those spatial relationships, interrelatedness, relativity, these fundamental perceptions identify what is there in experience. It means that this constancy mechanism means that you recognize a complex field of stimuli for what it is, without all the unnecessary details. For example, in psychology, when you observe the behaviors of a certain pathology in a patient over a long period of time, you eventually come to an understanding of that behavior, which is that behavior. You understand it, you know it. Under all of its different impulses and deprivations, efficiencies and deficiencies and idiosyncrasies, and suddenly you get it. And you get the root of it, and you get the idea of how to treat it, and you somehow know the whole syndrome without any of its extra, unnecessary, personal, temporal distractions which have preoccupied you throughout many sessions of analysis. You can apply that image, it's just an image, you can apply it to anything that you do. You can apply it to the way you function in the kitchen and the way you decide how to make your salad and so on. He is speaking about when the thing itself reveals itself to you as a result of frequent observation. And he's tracing this phenomenon back to very simple organic behaviors where nobody can impose any preconceptions because the animal only deals with the object. The difference, the differentiation that he makes between human abstraction and the way animals function is that we do not require the object in front of us to make the distinction. The animal is always the lower animals in all of their event perceptions are perceiving the event. We don't need to perceive the event. We can think about the abstraction itself. And this makes all the difference. This enables us to theorize about that psychological syndrome. We don't have to be in the presence of that behavior in order to recognize that we saw that behavior already 100 times. We can discuss that behavior in a classroom, and it's just about as real as when it's happening. So we can discuss the Vedic perception of the sounds of languages and their relationships in a very abstract way. We can know what they are. As Vladimir said, that's a mental understanding of language. So, anyway, we're still subconsciously taking in the visual field, taking in the sound field, registering all of the subtle differences in the gestalt without being conscious of how we do that. It's going on subconsciously all the time. So, I haven't seen you in a long time, and you suddenly walk into the room tonight, and I know from innumerable encounters that you're you, and and we have a history of relationship, and it's, you know, it's very familiar. But I don't think about that. It's just an immediate recognition of that happens in me of many layers of impressions. So our psychedelic friends in America in the 60s discovered that we imprint all the time. We do just like animals. We imprint in our nervous systems every event that happens every instant. And those imprints reinforce themselves until suddenly that's our reality. And, you know, what I know about you is the result of all of these imprints, and it's not you at all. So we do this with everything all the time, and we think we know something because of this constancy mechanism that enables mind to function in the vital organism at a very primitive level quite efficiently, and it functions in us also quite efficiently and subconsciously all the time. It's a kind of subconscious process of generalization and abstraction that is part of the organism. It has evolved from zero point, and it's there throughout the biosphere. So this abstraction that we do is done by mind in its human emergent form. It's the same thing which is totally involved in lower species, other species, the same processes are going on in us, but in us they become abstract and linguistic and symbolic, and human knowledge and understanding is the product of mind in its emergent, more or less characteristic, pure form. Involved still in life, involved still in the body, but as Sri Aurobindo says, we are the mental beings. So we are so totally mentalized that all of that which is happening subconsciously and which is driving animal existence in us is still happening subconsciously and driving our existence, but we're aware of it. And we can put names on it, because those impressions are so constant in us that we don't need to be stimulated by them to think about them. Once they're there, they're in the field of consciousness, and even if we haven't encountered them, they're still there. So we can become very subtly attuned to things going on in the human psyche, for example, without coming into direct contact with it.
Yeah, and will this also explain the same phenomena? And I'm looking at you when you're talking, how do I identify that it is the same person that I'm wearing and the one that I'm looking at?
It depends on how you look. But anyway, phenomenology is the whole science of how to answer that question. And it's a very worthwhile pursuit if you have time for it. So we occasionally cross questions like that. And the philosophy of Hegel and the philosophy of Heidegger and the philosophy of Merleau-Ponty and so on are all about, and Husserl, all about this question. So we're sort of presuming that we have an idea that that is a valid question and that we can spend a lot of good quality time analyzing it. But what we're... So we'll cross that road a number of times. The animal always needs an object present to make an association. The human being doesn't need to have an object present. Now, of course, there is subtle animal sensitivity also, so that the animal knows when the owner leaves the grocery store and starts home with the bag of food and runs up to the door and starts wagging his tail 10 minutes ahead of time. But for animal sensitivity, that means that the object is there. And 10 minutes later, the object is really physically right there. But for the animal sensitivity, the object of perception was there 10 minutes before it got there, and the recognition was there, and you know, all the behavior of recognition was already going on. So that's animal consciousness. It's been studied at great length. But the animal is not going to later on reflect on how he perceived that subtle vibration of his owner leaving the store and coming home, because it's only when that is in his field of perception that he is aware of it. So take my word for it. I get it from an expert who got a Nobel Prize for exactly this understanding, which had behind it thousands of experiments and just unbelievable research.
Part talked about the concept transmission with the 100 monkeys.
Yeah. So, the learning is what's going on. When Conrad Lorenz says that this process of constancy phenomena takes place at all levels and that that is cognition, he also says that every iota of that cognitive process, information processing, constitutes learning. And so it doesn't take very many repetitions of a certain pattern for it to be assimilated very quickly and transmitted culturally, not just by human beings, but by other species as well. And then he says something interesting that we'll come across here, that if we know Darwinian thinking, seems a little bit shocking. He says that the experience learned by a species is transmitted to its offspring genetically. Now, we know that that's a Lamarckianism, but it's a very sophisticated Lamarckianism, because you can also look at this as a kind of understanding that's common in biology today, which is known as epiphenomenalism, where many, many experiments are showing that the behavior of an organism, like a frog, under certain conditions is predictable. But under other conditions, the behavior of the frog becomes different. And that different behavior is reproduced in its offspring under those same conditions. And so it looks like what was learned there was passed on to the organism. But there's also in all species a limit which is unknown, which is called the elasticity of the phenotype. So we don't really know what the full range of this phenotype is. It has an elasticity that exceeds its habitual actions and responses. What it has learned so far is not all that it can learn. And so when we come into contact with someone like the mother, who has gone through a process of transformation, and the energy that she radiates stimulates in us another kind of behavior that we're not familiar with, then we begin to explore our own phenotypic elasticity, just as we would if we were on the battlefield and we were suddenly possessed by an adrenaline attack and we decided to lift that tank off of our friend. You know, I mean, human beings have been known to do such things. So we don't know, and no animal species really knows its inherent limits. So when the frog is stimulated under different lab conditions and produces in its offspring not only behaviors that are different, but extensions of behavior, organ growth, it has learned what is needed in that environment. And what its offspring becomes in that environment somehow retains that expression. But that expression was always a potential in that organism. And then there are all kinds of intermediate Darwinian, what is it called? increments. They're increments of development that are normally perceived under Darwinian conditions are the gradual expressions of a potential which was always there, but it had to follow a certain pattern of stimuli in order to fully develop. Then, what Lorenz finds is that animals retain a whole spectrum of possible behaviors that they don't necessarily require for survival anymore, but when they're stimulated under play conditions, they will reenact this whole spectrum of possible behaviors that they have accumulated over who knows how many generations in a short space of stimulated playtime. They will act out what they have learned for survival under other conditions. So we do that in a very sophisticated way on the stage, in the theater, when we play party games. We remember all of these different postures and language expressions that we've accumulated a lot in a lot of different circumstances, and we act out. We act out emotions that we've been repressing for ages, you know, that we wouldn't dare to show anybody in real life, but on stage, well, my daughter is an Odissi dancer, and she can stick that spear into that boar, you know, like, this is for real. And and that's primitive, but it's highly stylized in traditional dance. So we are always doing this, especially if we're performers, but we do it for our friends. And so the question of learning, you know, it is practically a question of being, because the way conscious organisms are in their life situations is they are conscious and they are processing information and they are learning all the time. Most get comfortable with a certain level of adaptation and stop learning. And even whole societies do that. And then Lorenz tells us that we have a conflict then in evolution between adaptation and cognition. Whereas human culture has taken this fundamental physiological function of the mind and leaped into this plane of pure mental abstraction, where, based upon experience, we can keep an object in our consciousness for a very long period of time. I just recited all of that, which I've read before in Lorenz and told you before, and I don't have to see all of that happening in nature in order to tell it to you. I can understand that that's what happens in nature from my own experience and from having read it lots of times. And so we are acting abstractly here. We are describing the way we are on the basis of our mental, rational understanding of patterns of behavior. Through pattern recognition, we get to this point of conscious interaction. And let's hope it has some evolutionary value and that we're not just wasting our time here. like people do in so many classrooms in the world every day. This is interesting. We can keep an object in our consciousness for a very long period of time, even a lifetime, and continually develop that object, which is now a mental object, and that's sort of what you're referring to, that becomes a cultural artifact. So these lectures get recorded, and they get transcribed, and they get read, and all of this understanding, which is right now a phenomenon in your consciousness and in my consciousness, and it, you are abstracting it all the time that it's happening, and eventually it becomes a publication which goes along a shelf with all kinds of similar publications. And this understanding of human functioning turns into, let's say, a theory of psychology. It becomes a widely understood theory of psychology and epistemology, and maybe even philosophy of evolution. Then it becomes a cultural artifact. And that cultural artifact is a strong determinant of values. That's how human civilization has evolved. Passing on cultural artifacts that convey traditional understandings and behaviors, elaborating on those, applying them, living by them, elevating them into generally accepted beneficial practices, cultural artifacts, until at some point they reach their limit of viability. And then we go to war, or we nuke our enemies, or we adopt practices that are ecologically sustainable instead of building more cars and highways. Whatever we have to do to survive, eventually we do try to do. But for a long time, what we try to do is continue to repeat the things that work for us. So the rational mind has been working for us very well for a couple of thousand years or more or less, maybe much longer. But what we see historically are its transformations over the last 2,000 years. And we can see that these traditions come and go. So far, none of them has been unlimited. But at the same time, the rational exfoliations from age to age have had advantages and disadvantages that the others haven't had. And until now, we're in a state where we've overpopulated the planet, which we never did before, which means that we've become much smarter than everything else on the planet in a certain manipulative, rational way. We can frame our understanding of everything. We have now got everything in reserve. And this was Heidegger's big discovery. At the end of his extraordinary lifetime of philosophy, he came to the conclusion that this inframing of knowledge is what technology represents. And because technology is fundamentally rational, logical, physical system, and it holds in reserve all the energy of the planet, we have to figure out a way to liberate ourselves from that creation. Otherwise, that creation itself, which is based upon rational, manipulative power, power over nature, power over the reserve, the virtualization of life, that technology has its own momentum and its own principles of operation, and at some point it becomes very dangerous. And the human being becomes so subservient to it, so inclined to mistake it for the world, so focused on the frame that it's so much out of touch with the world itself that it believes that manipulating the frame is what being is about. And because it's no longer in tune to being itself, it can just continue manipulating the frame until there's nothing left but the frame. And human existence finds itself unsupportable. Well, that's a kind of a glum view of things. It tends towards the pathological. Surely humanity is above that, right? If evolution is the fundamental reality, and if it is consciousness that is evolving and not structure, which is seems to be the indication from everything that we've seen, and let me remind you, for example, that sight is an instrument of perception. Perception is a level of physical consciousness. It is omnipresent in the animal kingdom, from the one-celled organism on up. So, if we take perception as an indication, then evolution, regardless of the structure, regardless of whether it's a one cell that perceives light or a complex human eye, it's performing the function of perception at all those different levels of complexity. So it's consciousness which is evolving, not just structure. It is not just biological structures that are evolving, it is consciousness that is evolving in those structures, because there is no difference between consciousness and structure. There is no difference between cognition and behavior. Yes, that's what, you know, last time we saw the ultra-Darwinian saying, that Darwinism itself indicates that human consciousness will become something which is incomprehensible to us now. Even the analytical materialistic Darwinian has figured that out. Now, we possess a mechanism that is capable of absorbing almost incredible numbers of individual observation records, of retaining them over long periods, and on top of all that, evaluating them statistically. We evaluate them subconsciously, and we also evaluate them statistically on the basis of how we evaluate them. You know, we see a trend, a pattern, and then we analyze the pattern, and then we make predictions, and so it's just an extension of the same thing that all other creatures are doing. Now, evaluating them statistically is the rational abstract function, but observing them and storing them is not. At least this is a distinction that can be made, not only in the human being, but at many levels. In ancient Indian psychology, the term for this subconscious function is the citta. So, what I would like to undertake at this point is an exploration of the question, what then is mind? That, before we can answer the question of the evolution of mind in relation to supermind, we have to understand, on the basis of everything that we've heard up until now, and a number of other things that we will hear, what exactly, we'll have to be able to determine on the basis of all that, what exactly is mind? So that's what I want us to contemplate. I want us to consciously place this question in a very large contemplative zone, so that into that zone may flow everything that mind is. So that what mind is becomes known, absolutely, directly, gnostically, integrally known. I want us to know what mind is. Now, we can begin with some theories, and we can follow those theories through observation and reflection and contemplation, but at some point we should come into resonance with mind itself, in us, in others, in the biosphere, in the cosmic dimension. We should do what Sri Aurobindo constantly urges us to do, and that is universalize our limited, ordinary mental faculty. He says that this is essential. If we are going to be yogis and evolutionary beings, one of the first things, he says, that is necessary is the universalization of mind. So how better to do that than to focus on mind itself, which according to him is a universal plane of existence. It's there in the physical, it's in the vital, it's on its own pure plane. We know it mentally pretty well. We can learn a lot about it just by reflecting on our own version of it. So there is a chapter in the Synthesis of Yoga in which Sri Aurobindo explains in great detail what mind is. And in Western tradition, Aristotle does the same thing. So we will look also at some Aristotle in this class, because Aristotle's descriptions of mind are almost the same as these. And he begins with soul and ends with overmind, Aristotle, and covers all the degrees of behavior in between, from the irrational animal to the rational human to the god, and so on. So Aristotle is very interesting to read. If you have a question like this, if you don't have a question, then Aristotle is impossible to read. But if you read a book like Aristotle's De Anima, it's absolutely wonderful, every word of it. So I'll show you some of that. But right now, I'm going to go to page 647 in this book. And if you have the new edition of the Synthesis of Yoga, then that's the page that you'll find this on. And if you have the old edition of the Synthesis of Yoga, you will find it on page 620. I'm trying to be helpful here. And because time is getting short, I'll probably just indicate to you where these things are and hope that you will do some homework. Because it's essential to start here, as far as this question goes, what is mind? And I'll just go through a part here which is so similar to Conrad Lorenz that our minds have an opportunity to perform this constancy phenomenon. We will be able to recognize almost subconsciously the relationship between what we were just reading and discussing and this classical Indian psychological understanding. This is the classical Indian psychological understanding of what mind is. And it has three levels, citta, manas, and buddhi. And we will read the summary of these three levels. Citta is, the basic consciousness, is largely subconscious. It has, open and hidden, two kinds of action, one passive or receptive, the other active or reactive and formative. As a passive power, it receives all impacts, even those of which the mind is unaware or to which it is inattentive. And it stores them in an immense reserve of passive, subconscious memory on which the mind, as an active memory, can draw. Okay, so there's one thing that mind is. It's receptive and active memory impressions. But ordinarily, the mind draws only what it had observed and understood at the time. More easily, what it had observed well and understood carefully. Less easily, what it had observed carelessly or ill understood. At the same time, there's a power in consciousness to send up to the active mind for use what that mind had not at all observed or attended to or even consciously experienced. This power only acts observably in abnormal conditions, when some part of the subconscious citta comes, as it were, to the surface, or when the subliminal being in us appears on the threshold and for a time plays some part in the outer chamber of mentality, where we get these vivid impressions from somewhere, where the direct intercourse and commerce with the external world takes place, and our inner dealings with ourselves develop on the surface. This action of memory is so fundamental to the entire mental action that it is sometimes said, memory is the man. Even in the submental action of the body and life, which is full of this subconscient citta, though not under the control of the conscious mind, there is a vital and physical memory. The vital and physical habits are largely formed by this submental memory. This means not only the human being, that the vital and physical habits of animals are being formed by this subconscious, active and passive memory.
What's the relation between mind and memory?
Yeah. Let's just go a little further here. There are three levels, and you'll see the one that you recognize as mind. But this is a spectrum of mind. So we're going to go from the most physical, subconscious, to the most abstract and rational, to the most luminous and supra-rational. It's all mind.
The inconscient is the mind?
Yes. Subconscious mind. Mind involved. That's how Sri Aurobindo puts it. Mind is involved even in the atom. And so the formation of life, which is processing carbohydrates and reproducing, replicating species and harnessing energy, Conrad Lorenz says there's no difference between harnessing energy for life and learning. They go together. So, on the vital level, mind is involved in organizing life for the sake of survival and joy and fun and conquest and back to survival again. Vital phenomena, says Sri Aurobindo, are also ethical. I mean, the vital being senses what's right and wrong and acts accordingly without thinking about right and wrong. Thinking about right and wrong is an abstract rational function, but behaving right and wrong is a very vital function, which human beings engage in all the time. They try to do what's right and they end up doing what's wrong because they're stupid. Because they have emotional feelings that determine their actions. And that's the Buddha, according to the Tibetans, also. But the peaceful right action is also the Buddha. So it's whatever arises is consciousness. And that's really Sri Aurobindo's perception of things. They're just different levels of it.
Consciousness is in
everything. The mind as we know it is a level of the emergence of consciousness. But there's a supramental consciousness which is not mind. So consciousness has a huge
range.
Thank you.
Would it be right to say that the understanding of consciousness would come through the mind? That is why we look at it that way.
Yeah, reflection and...
All our understanding would come through the mind. So to understand consciousness, we have to use the mind.
Well, understanding is a mental function. But gathering experience is also a mental function. But it's subconscious.
Is there so,
yeah, but that we have to wait for Aristotle for that one. Let me go on here. Even in the submental action of body and life, the vital and physical habits are largely formed by this submental memory. For this reason, they can be changed to an indefinite extent by a more powerful action of conscious mind and will. So conscious mind and will can change the patterns that the vital mind and the vital will believe are good for it until something happens that's shocking, and then the rational mind can change those habits. So, you know, I could come up with lots of examples of that. I'm sure you can too. So Sri Aurobindo is always saying that what the conscious mind and will has to do in yoga is change the vital patterns. And the mental patterns. And maybe even the physical patterns at some point. The matter itself. We spoke about that a little bit last time. The evolution of matter itself would mean a shift in spatial relations at the cosmic atomic level. But we can change all of this when that can be developed and can find, when the conscious mind and will, when that can be developed and can find means to communicate to the subconscious citta, the will of the spirit, for a new law of life, for a new law of vital and physical action. Even the whole constitution of our life and body may be described as a bundle of habits formed by the past evolution in nature. This is Conrad Lorenz. The past evolution in nature has been the evolution of the citta. in all the species. And that's what we are. The accumulation of all those past patterns and habits. But highly modified by our rational culture. Even the whole constitution may just be described as a bundle of habits formed by the past evolution in nature and held together by the persistent memory of this secret consciousness. For citta, the primary stuff of consciousness, is like prana and body universal. Prana and body universal. Consciousness, subconscious mind in nature. So you can actually learn to perceive in the world around you and in you all the time universal prana. And you can lose your sense of separate individuality. And you can learn your sense of, you lose your sense of saying to yourself, oh, that's the species Panthera, and that's the species Scorpio, and so on. And you can know that that scorpion emanation and that scorpion grabbing that piece of meat and eating it and putting its tail up in the air is just citta, it's just universal consciousness performing its habit. And you are performing that habit with it in your consciousness and pulsating with universal prana on that level of organization. And you know damn well you're not going to grab it, because part of that understanding is that that tail is lethal. And that tail also understands itself as being lethal. And it's sending you a vibration that says, don't grab me. And so this is consciousness working on a very basic level, but it's also a beautiful continuum of divine consciousness organized on that level. And other animals learn that about the scorpion also and stay the hell away from it if they can. So he says, but in fact all action of the mind or inner instrument arises out of this citta. So everything that we know is a result of constancy phenomena that occurs at a subconscious level of perception. First, and sometimes becomes immediately conscious in the conscious mind, but sometimes it's just stored there for a long time until something happens that brings it up. Partly conscient, partly subconscient or subliminal to our active mentality. Our active mentality is a very narrow bandwidth which we take for the reality of existence. So one of the things that evolutionary consciousness has grasped from Bergson and Sri Aurobindo all the way up to the present is that that narrow bandwidth is just that, and it has to be expanded. It has to be reintegrated with all the levels below and with all the levels above in order for mind in its totality to connect with supermind and become a channel that connects the top to the bottom. That's the process of yoga, of Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga. Ascend through the mind, bring the supramental force down into all the planes and reorganize them. He says the process begins with systematic thought. But thought can mean many things. So not just systematic rational thought, but systematic contemplative thought. And eventually pure thought itself, which is not conditioned by experience. But it has a path. Things are interlinked on the pure plane of thought. Everything which is below the pure plane of thought is interlinked on the pure plane of thought. Because reality is made up of all the planes. So mind plane, the true mind plane, knows the organization of all the planes and all the... Probably. Let's hold that one for later. Hold that one. Because it's not really important to know what I think about that. What's important is for you to explore the evolutionary potentiality of mind and to find the answer to that question. And find the answer to all the other questions by allowing your mind to universalize itself and know directly mind, where Sri Aurobindo and all the rest of them are located vibrationally. Because it's not a personal thing, it's a plane of consciousness. So Sri Aurobindo has transmitted higher mind consciousness. He has transmitted...
What is the correlation between mind and plane of consciousness?
Find it. Contemplate it. Sri Aurobindo has transmitted higher mind consciousness, which is related to ordinary mental consciousness, which is related to mind, that is involved in vital consciousness. There are different levels of mind. So we're used to functioning on this narrow mental bandwidth called rational mind. But consciousness has many levels, and mind has many levels, and so we need to begin to explore by gathering and assembling and contemplating how the world inside us and outside of us is organized. And as we contemplate how the world itself is organized, we are putting our mind in touch with universal mind, the world itself. We're just part of that whole field called mind. Each one of us is a mental being organized by mind, not predominantly organized by life and body. And because we are all the same, we can resonate with mind itself in all of our different habitual movements. But we can get out of those habitual movements also and resonate with mind itself in all of those higher mind beings and all of those over mind beings and all of those involved lower vital mind beings. We're connected. Mind and life and body are connected on this planet. It is a threefold evolutionary being. And right now, what we want to find out is, how can we understand mind as a principle of organization in existence, a principle of existence, and then contemplate that mind as itself, what it is, what it does, how it does it, all of its manifestations, from language and society on the human level to higher ideals, to the behavior patterns that we observe around us. How can we enter into a contemplation of mind itself on all of its planes of formation and impersonalize, depersonalize our conception of what it is? You know, it's not just how we evaluate our neighbor's behavior and make judgments and so on. It's much vaster than that. It's not just how we schedule our day so that we economize our energy. It's not just those people sitting on the court who make the laws that are supposed to make society better. It's many, many different functions going on at many, many different levels all the time. So we can learn to follow the movements of mind from the citta, which is subconscious, to the manas, which we didn't get to tonight, to the buddhi, which is the higher rational mind and will. That's a continuum. You know, we gather these impressions in the citta, they're sent up to our perception, and we see them in action, and we start to define them and remember them and categorize them and analyze them, and then we're functioning and see the whole pattern and decide what's best about it and what's not so good about it, and model it, and maybe even paint it and sculpt it and write poetry about it. And then we're in the buddhi, you know, citta, manas, buddhi. And then at some point we come to yoga, and the potentiality of evolving beyond citta, manas, and buddhi, vijnana, and figuring out, really, literally, figuring out how to do it. Putting our energy into how to move this mind field out of its habitual patterns and allow it to be irradiated by that other higher mind which Sri Aurobindo describes, and we'll get to it, which has characteristic functions, just like the mind that we know has characteristic functions. That higher mind has characteristic functions, which he has described. And beyond that, the intuitive mind has characteristic functions and energies and ways of processing information, which he has described. So this building...
Is the mind located here?
No. The brain is located there. So, I'm sorry, but no. But what you can do is, your mind is located also in your heart and in your nervous system and in the chakras, and beyond, it's located in the mind field. Mind is a level of evolution of consciousness, and we all participate in it. But we're stuck to our what we read yesterday, and we think that's our mind. You know, my impressions are my mind, and your impressions are your mind, and his impressions are his mind. But we're trying to now move out of that way of thinking and realize that mind is acting through him and you and me and all of us and all the other creatures on earth, and it's also in touch with the overmind luminosities of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother and the Buddha and everybody. Mind is a level of existence. So we want to figure out, literally, figure out how to allow these mental behaviors that we associate with and think of as ourselves, how to allow those to be illuminated by a higher force of mind, a higher mind, a more luminous mind, And then how to bring that down into our normal activities and let our normal activities be driven by something other than that habitual mind, to be constantly channeling that more universal, more luminous mind, re-energizing the vital, mental, physical complex and expanding it. And one of the early steps in that process is universalizing mind. So Sri Aurobindo says again and again, it's absolutely essential to depersonalize, universalize, perceive actually mind as a universal field of consciousness. And whether a person is behaving according to the law or not is being determined by that mind field. You know, it's like the idea of right and wrong, which you're picking up from someone's behavior, is a behavior of mind, both in that person and in your picking up of it. So how is mind functioning, and how can it get out of some of its rational patterns and its irrational patterns and its stupidities and its predetermined patterns from ancient evolution? You know, how can it loosen up the stakes, as Sri Aurobindo puts it, the tent poles of form? How can it loosen those all up and expand them so that a higher principle of consciousness than mind can begin to interpenetrate with intuitions and perceptions and will that will help the human species evolve new instrumentalities and save the planet? Because mechanism, according to the mother, no mechanism, no structure itself is going to solve those problems. They're not going to get solved technologically.
I mean, you're not going to save this planet, you save yourself.
Yes. First.
Yeah.
And again, you know, this comes back to Auroville. No systems, no structures, no amount of trips of the bus around the Matra Mandir are going to save the world. It's only a transformation of consciousness that can do that. And it's good to have all of these structures that help us get from point A to point B, no doubt, but that's not what Auroville is for. So the possibilities of evolution have been known for some time. The question is how. We have to figure out how to do it now that we know that it's what's going on and that we're expected to get up to speed with it because it's crucial. And I don't want a philosophy of evolution to be something that just hits the shelf with a nice binding on it, you know. That's not what it's about. The philosophy of evolution is about what is the reality of our existence and how can we behave and function accordingly, according to the values of evolution and not the values of preserving the monster. That's going to be the subject of the lecture after next. And we're really way over time tonight. So we're just getting started. There are three pages here in the synthesis of yoga. There's that one about citta, and then there is the one about manas, which comes up shortly thereafter. There it is, manas, the sense mind, and all about how that works in us, and you'll recognize all of it. And then the buddhi, and what that is, and how it works, and you'll recognize all of that. So this is a very good place to start understanding what mind is. to start understanding what mind is. Not, that doesn't mean putting your consciousness in touch with the reality itself. That's a little bit further along. Yes?
What's the name of this chapter?
The Instruments of the Spirit. Significant title.
Yes, so we should read up this three.
So if you would read up these, if you would read up this handout and read up those few pages, we would be ahead of the game here.
Heavy work.
Heavy work, yes, mental work. Otherwise known as Jnana Yoga.